which, thank you very much, Jean-Pierre, and thank you for inviting me. We've heard a lot about Myers Hormus, and I have to say that I had to do some digging myself in order to sort of re-engage with the material. So a lot of this is already published and common knowledge, but hopefully I'll remind you about the port from a maritime perspective, which is essentially the hat that I wear most of the time. And also to say, just to acknowledge the role, obvious, very important role that my colleague, Professor David Peacock, made, actually bringing me to the site in the first place, and acknowledge how much we miss him. So the title hinted at the idea of looking at Indo-Roman trade. I think there are others probably less more qualified rather than myself to talk more in detail about this. So I am going to very much focus on the port. I'm going to look at the archaeology of the port or aspects of the archaeology that give us insight into the way that the port functioned. And then a little bit more in terms of that live space. Who were the people there? What were they doing? What sort of marine-related activities, whether it's relating to the activities of the port, the cargoes, the unloading, the storage, or whether it's more workaday activities such as fishing and repairing vessels. And then I'm going to go on to look briefly at the evidence for the boats and ships themselves. This will be more broadly. We know that there's a slightly important site just down the coast, which has also revealed some really interesting material in terms of the direct evidence for the ships and the sails, as JP mentioned earlier. And then touch on a little bit the aspects of connectivity. We've heard lots of papers looking inland in terms of the different routes that were options in terms of going to Myers Hormus or Berenike. But I'd like to sort of think about that perhaps a little bit more broadly in the context of seasonality and when you actually physically could travel along these, well, not so much the routes, but the Nile, and then how that links in with the seasonal sailing season in the Mediterranean and likewise the monsoon season. So that's essentially what I'm going to be focusing on. The location of Myers Hormus, I don't really need to mention it. And obviously that links in with a far more extensive system of ports and trade within this Indo-Roman trading system right across to India and beyond. So the site of Myers Hormus, if we look at some of the textual evidence, and again, this is very familiar to this audience, this is essentially the first point of departure, or the last point of entry, as recorded in the Periplus, this first century AD description of many of the ports that I just illustrated. So, and it obviously is connected very much with its sister port to the south, Berenike. So just to remind ourselves of the important role that it played. And that's further corroborated by Strabo's remarks when he talks about the sort of scale of activity. He doesn't say if this is every day or every year or throughout its life, but I think we can probably look at some sort of at least annual activity. So we're looking at a site where there's a lot of, certainly at particular times of year, there's a lot of shipping, a lot of material coming out in and out, and obviously from the data from the Eastern Desert certainly supports that. This was a view of the site when David first visited back in the late or early 90s. As most of you know, that this coastline looks very different now, but I'm showing it to draw attention to the sort of darker area here, which is the silted channel entrance, which will be focus of the first half of my lecture, and to remind you, obviously, of the dating of the site. From roughly the first century, late first century BC to the early mid third century AD. And to remind you that we weren't the first people to go and visit the site. It had been previously investigated, although with a much larger focus on the Islamic period, which obviously is not going to be the focus of my talk today. And to show again the loan document, the critical papyri, that along with investigations that David undertook prior to actually working at the site, looking at satellite images and thinking about the landscape, sort of nailed the fact that this is Myos Hormuz, the site of trade on the Red Sea coast. And obviously the huge range of materials that we've been seeing, insight into a lot more detail, I guess it's the archaeological lure, this rich wealth of material that we have to investigate, and we've heard a lot more about. But this is my focus, was very much looking at the maritime context of the site, looking at the port, reminding ourselves that the main settlement was on this former Pleistocene reef, sort of elevated about 8 meters above the rest of the site, and the critical factors being these two wadi systems that feed into the site, and previously, as I will show you, would have been waterlogged and facilitated quite nice shelter in the lee of this Pleistocene reef, so that the vessels would have come in here and sheltered up in the harbour, which was my task to find. So we undertook a series of different approaches, both excavation, obviously, but in terms of finding the site, a topographical survey, focused targeted geophysics, excavation, and sedimentology. And I'll briefly touch on all of these. It was a largely magnetometer survey that confirmed that this much darker area, which we presumed was a silted lagoon, was the interface essentially between the higher topography of the main site going down to what was previously the waterlogged lagoon, which is now silted up. And these are some of the excavation areas at the base of that Pleistocene ridge that we investigated to try and ascertain the nature of the port site. The key site that we've heard quite a lot about and already seen the photograph from Myos Hormuz in some ways, was Trench 7A. And this was the area where, from at least the late first through second, through to the beginning of the second century at least, the main focus of ships are offloading and storing goods that were coming in and being exported from the site. A very rudimentary sort of workaday facility provided, basically trying to defend against the sea, so a series of reused amphoras lined up and stone walls as well, as we'll see, taking on different natures depending on exactly where they were around the back of the bay, both to defend the sea or the ingression from the sea via the lagoon, but also to act as different areas of storage. So we have some what we presume are waterlogged basins at the time. So there were definitely demarcated areas where different, presumably different types of materials were being stored as they were offloaded onto this this area, which I'll show you a bit more detail of in a minute. So this is the plan of the site with the different basins and the different walls and sea defences and areas for storage, and then moving towards the jetty that extended out into the lagoon. So these are some of the amphora walls and the stone walls. You can see they're all largely reused, not generally intact, but not broken. I mean, smaller pieces were used for packing along with earth. And Roberta's already shown us some of the specific materials and how they were arranged. This is the basin that we believe was used for sort of keeping things cool when it was offloaded. Again, we need to do some more investigation. I think we were discussing this at lunchtime into the relative sea levels at the time of use. And this is the the jetty that's made up of these first century BC AD amphoras, largely not entirely intact, but quite substantial in their remains, that extended about 30 metres out into the lagoon. And we can see we didn't fully excavate it right to the base, regrettably. Roberta Tomba and I have ideas of going back and further excavating this to really work out, now that we have more and greater understanding of the jetty, how it was constructed and how it related to the base of the lagoon. But we can certainly see that the amphora were either laid on one level or chopped off, as it were, here. This is more of the interface between the land and sea. This is a cross-section I took, showing how the natural bedrock of the Pleistocene reef extends into, by the use of the amphora being laid, we don't know how many courses deep, and then packed with earth and broken an amphora, and then at this sort of earth, trampled earth floor above. So this is basically extending that working area, extending a jetty out into the lagoon so that people could offload from the boats much more easily. Thank you, Steve, for this. this shows you a sort of cross-section. Obviously, we're not sure about the actual base, but it gives you an idea of, in principle, how this was used. And when we did more investigation, we were able to ascertain that, in fact, this approach to construction is something which is not unusual in the Roman Empire. It extends across the breadth of the Mediterranean, largely within areas where there is quite large river systems. So estuarine areas, areas of unstable, sort of not solid geology, should we say. And obviously the amphora were of a shape and a weight that were not as heavy, I guess, than, say, solid stone. So they were more adaptable to actually trying to consolidate land in an estuarine in context. So this was a very useful means of actually consolidating these coastal landscapes in more vulnerable areas. And there's a whole variety. The publications that I referenced in the last slide will show you the different types of materials and how they're approached in different ways. But I think it's important to remember that you know, Roman harbour constructions are not always these monumental stone-built affairs that we're used to seeing at great portuses and other sites around the Mediterranean. They take on different forms depending on their context. And also to remind you, slightly blurry, but of the very more recent finds at Massouris at the other end of the Indian Ocean trading system in southern India, Patnam, the site that's been excavated by KCHR. And this is a mud key that was associated with the waterfront. So again, a different type of approach to securing vessels and offloading. And the waterfront, as you probably recall, extended along the base, and we have evidence again for these different responses to different sea levels or inundations, so different approaches to trying to protect that interface through to the first century AD sort of header system using stone, which has mortar in between, so obviously a bit more robust, but also behind the immediate waterfront areas of maintaining ships, of working with the ships, offloading, etc. So it's starting to give us a fuller understanding of the activities that were associated both with the port and its maintenance facilities. The other big challenge I had was to really ascertain the nature of the harbour and the relative sea levels and the process of siltation that happened subsequently, which at that stage I was an archaeologist trying to be a geomorphologist, so I undertook a series of over 100 pits and auger sections across the now silted lagoon, which is perhaps a little over the top, but essentially the results of that, as published, indicate that this was, in fact, accessible, fortunately, certainly the late second, perhaps third millennium. I think it's probably one of the reasons that the harbour declined, because of the problems and the challenges that were faced by keeping the harbour silt-free. And there's other evidence, as you're probably aware, to corroborate that in terms of dredging, etc. But I don't have time to look at that now. So I'm just going to have a quick look at some of the other trenches that are relevant in a way to give us a bit more insight into the nature of the port, but also the people and activities within the port. So there's Trench 10, which I'll look at immediately, Trench 2B, and then finally Trench A, which Marijke has already mentioned. In fact, the last two have been discussed in different contexts. This is a plan of Trench 10A, and this is a view of the site, which is essentially facilitating a number of furnaces in the the first century, mostly in the AD period, and there's lots of evidence of there's bits of barnacles that were potentially part of careening processes of boats, and there was also evidence for furnaces, as I said, and metalworking, etc. So we're presuming there's a series of pits here that we believe, but we're not sure, were used for cooling purposes. So we're assuming that this was an area that was very much connected with the maintenance of the ships. And now on the top, here we're now right in the middle of the site, right up on the top of the ancient reef, we have a very different type of signature, stone-based walls. Most of the architecture in Corsair is mud brick, but here we have a much more monumental-looking building, which dates largely to the first century AD, and has been interpreted because of the sort of more ornate aspects of the architecture to something that was equivalent to perhaps a temple or a synagogue. We have very limited material evidence to support that interpretation, regrettably. But we do have the area of the fodder that Marijke was talking about, which we think is where the animals were kept outside of this building. So, and then Trench A, which has always been of great interest. This is sitting above the main part of the harbour, above the jetty, looking out to sea. And we have quite an extensive period of occupation from the late 1st to the whole period of the site to the early 3rd. Century AD, a street system with a series of buildings, houses, we presume, a bakery. In the later periods, we have evidence for some furnaces as well in this area, and perhaps quarters relating to the occupation of Indian people. Maybe there's certainly Indian ceramics. And also storage of fishing gear and material that had been recycled from the ship, so reused ship timbers as well. So this was a constantly active area, presumably because of its connection in with the port. I'm not going to mention the epigraphy and how we can start to identify people, because there are many, many people here far more qualified to talk on this, but I will move on to some of the other activities within the port which relate to fishing. This material was looked at extensively by Ross Thomas, who focused his PhD on not just at Myers Hormus but Berenike and Ayla. And we can see a whole range of materials from weights and nets of different types, hooks, fenders for boats, needles for stitching and making nets. So we're starting to get an insight into the different approaches to fishing and offshore, nearshore, on the reefs, that sort of thing. And he's looked extensively into the different approaches, but also where they were found within the site. So we can start seeing areas of people living on the site who were potentially sustaining themselves, if not making a living out of fishing. Likewise, we have evidence across the site, not just down by the port, but also in the top, to do with, not so much ship maintenance on the top, but storage of equipment and things to do with fishing. But ship maintenance, we've got extensive amounts of copper tacks and also lead sheathing, which would have been adhered to the hulls of the vessels to protect it from wood-boring organisms. We've got lots of, like Berenike, evidence for different bits of rigging that were also not, when they weren't being used on the boats, were being stored in certain areas. So these were items that were presumably important to the people that owned them. So they were taking things off ships or using them, storing them through the seasons, what have you. And then there's obviously the evidence for sailing, which we've heard from John Peter. We've been very fortunate to find, as he's told us about, evidence for the Indian cloth that was used for sails and the reinforcing straps that he's mentioned. Here we've actually got one of these braille rings that John Peter mentioned attached to the sail. And these were made out of either bone or wood. They have been found extensively across the site, some of them stored, but a lot of them in the Sabak regions. And they help to give us an understanding of perhaps whether there were different sizes, so whether that indicates we've got, larger sails, smaller sails, a number of smaller sails. But it's starting to give us an insight into how these different, the sail makeup. And again, I'm showing the same picture, but this shows you the braille rings on the front of the sail. This is this image from Ostia, and John Peter showed you exactly how that you furl the sails accordingly. What's interesting is that we do have quite a lot of material, and this is a range of material now from Berenice, where they found this very exciting frame two seasons ago, and we've got quite a lot of recycled timber, some of the material coming from Trench 8, as I mentioned. In contrast to what you were saying earlier, we're still of the opinion, and the analysis supports that, that a lot of this material was actually recycled from coming from India. Obviously, the cloth, the cotton, rather, for the sails, but also the recycled timber, both of which are being used very specifically. So the working hypothesis is that a lot of material is coming from India in terms of the construction of the vessels and also the sails. But in fact, the way that they're being built is very much in keeping with the traditions in the Mediterranean. So they're using mortise and tenon construction, shell first-built vessels, and the sails are sails of square-sailed vessels with the rig, which you would commonly see in the Mediterranean at this period. So it's an interesting quandary that John Peter's already touched on. But whatever other evidence do we have for the nature of the vessels? We've got the direct evidence through the bits of timber reused and some abandoned. We've also got evidence for rigging. And we also have an insight into all the other different boats that were operating in these port areas, not just at Myers Hormuz, but from the Periplus, more extensively from the Indian Ocean. And these are some little ethnographic images, and these are from the 17th century, just to give you an idea of this potential continuity of these vessel types. Sewn boats, dugouts. I just remind you of this very exciting find from Mazuris, where they actually found a dugout attached by bollards to the key that I showed you earlier from the, well, it's a radio commentator to the late BC, early AD. So we're beginning to build up our corpus of understanding, and obviously the iconography, which is always very schematic, but gives us an insight into cargoes, and also the nature of the vessels, again, with these square sails, very in keeping with the vessels of the Mediterranean. And shipwrecks. Not a lot, but there are some. There's the Fury Shoals wreck, which is very familiar and dived frequently, with a lot of mostly 1st century BC material. And then there's this find, actually, from the entrance of Corsair itself, of Myers Hormuz, which I haven't dived, unfortunately. It's quite deep. But they again support this idea that, unsurprisingly, we have got material in terms of the amphora from this site that we found a few years ago whilst doing some survey work in the Red Sea, from as far west in the Mediterranean as Spain, Dressel 20s. We've got the Italian and also a lot of the Alexandria amphora as well. And we also have evidence for iron anchors, so it gives you an idea of the sort of size of the vessel. There's four of them on this one, and also the way that they were mooring. And there's some hint at lead sheathing as well. So we're actually seeing in the shipwreck evidence these things being corroborated through to the terrestrial evidence. So more of those, please, I think. So what does this mean in terms of what we understand about the vessels? Well, as I've already said, we're so far with not extensive evidence, we're able to imply that a lot of the construction and the rigging was very similar to the Mediterranean, but perhaps the materials were coming from elsewhere, from India, maybe East Africa. But again, we'd need to do some more research into this. And in terms of their performance, this is work that was done by my colleague Julian Wright, looking at what the performance levels were, particularly sailing upwind, as I'll finish in a minute, just thinking about the maritime context. They were able to navigate up the Red Sea, which is the big challenge, as I'm sure you're equally aware of as I am, the sort of the physical maritime, environmental context of operating out of these ports was a challenge. Obviously, it was very much dependent upon the annual monsoons, so we were utilising the monsoons. I don't need to tell this audience how that works in an annual cycle, and is supported by the evidence directly from the Periplus. But what happened when you started to want to go back, either leaving or going up and down the Red Sea itself? Well, as we know, the Red Sea is notorious for prevailing northerlies, and this pretty much is predominant throughout the year. There's a slight lull in the winter period when the southerlies, because of the monsoons, extend a little way up the southern reaches of the Red Sea. But essentially, you're fine going out, you're fine going to India, but you've got to negotiate those northerlies when you return to the ports. And this obviously, I'm nearly there, I've got like three slides here. This obviously made had an impact on the choices that people made in terms of seasonality and, you know, working with the winds, both the monsoons and back into the Red Sea. And then we come to questions about, well, what, how do you make choices about which port you determine to offload in, assuming this is the first few centuries AD, because the voyage north was much greater. To get to Myers Hormuz, you had, you know, another 200 or so kilometres to travel. And these are some calculations that, again, my colleague Julian Wright has made about, you know, possible options. We know that the routes are there, the evidence for that, but actually undertaking that maritime voyage faces different challenges. And then you need to link that in with, oh, and the third one, obviously, is the option of going all the way to the top, to Klaisma, to Suez, and then negotiating the canal route, whatever, when it was open. But the seasonality connected with that. And this is a table that a colleague of mine, John Cooper's, put together, thinking about how complex that was, really, in terms of the seasons of the from the Mediterranean sailing season through to the Nile flood, and when it was actually feasible to manoeuvre vessels around on different sections of the Nile, depending on drafts of your vessels. Not that it was easy to navigate on the Nile anyway, but so there were certain times prior to the flood when you wouldn't have been able to do that, and how that fits in then with the whole system of the monsoons and the process of departing from the Red Sea, and then obviously the actual Mediterranean sailing season. So these are unanswered questions, but I think they're things that we need to bear in mind along with, you know, the political context. Is the practical things to do with the different routes, the selection of ports, you know, the topography, the shelter provided, the specific insulations that are offered, the peoples in the ports. We've heard a lot of that, which is good, because I think it's really time that we started looking more specifically at the peoples, the variety of different ship and boat types, and how that all fits in with these different seasonal migration periods and the different sailing seasons. So, thank you for your attention, and I think that complex situation needs to be studied further.
So, thank you, Lucy, for this.